It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. We recently talked with Pittsburgh Post-Gazette writer Diana Nelson-Jones about neighborhoods experiencing a resurgence in new development and how to build housing at a rate that does not include the working class, that excludes the working class. But how do we motivate developers to build affordable housing? Richard Swartz, executive director of Bloomfield Garfield Corporation, joins us along with Diana Nelson-Jones to address this question. And again, that question is, how do we build housing at a rate that does not exclude the working class? I want to make that clear. If you'd like to weigh in on the conversation, you can call 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Our email address, esspgh@wesa.fm, and you can reach us on Twitter at esspgh and follow the conversation at #EPLive. What has the search for affordable housing been like for you? Share your story with us at 412-246-2002. Diana, what are the problems that you're seeing around affordable housing for working class people?
Well, people's incomes are falling. Apartments that used to be more available to people with subsidies are starting to evaporate. We were just talking about this offline. HUD's out of the business of subsidizing housing. They're getting out of the business. So it befalls a developer to find a way to get something out of it. And low-income tax credits are available, but they're highly competitive. There are only so many in the state. And I was just talking with Rick. They are overprescribed in this area. So what is somebody to do? I mean, Chuck Keenan was speaking. He's the administrator in the Bureau of Homeless Services for Allegheny County Department of Human Services. He spoke at a meeting last spring saying that if the government's not going to build these, where are we going to get them? So there are ways to get them, but who in his profit-driven right mind is going to rent to somebody who's working, you know, a menial job? Maybe she's a single mother, can't maybe afford it. She maybe $500 rent would be possible for her. It's you can't find $500 rent in a place that, you know, that you would want to live in. So,
and that's not and that's not always been true for Pittsburgh. In fact, it's been in fairly recent years, hasn't it, that the rent has really skyrocketed?
Well, some neighborhoods are getting some legs. I mean, the Hill District's starting to get a little bit expensive in places. Bloomfield, which has always been affordable, is starting to, you know, march upward. Parts of the North Side, it's ridiculous, you know, what alley houses are going for, or at least the asking price. So, yeah, Pittsburgh's gentrifying and becoming, you know, more sort of popular. At the same time, there are many neighborhoods that are really in terrible, terrible, dire consequences. So we have the same – you look at the whole country and the disparity between rich and poor, we're seeing it here. And without subsidized housing, which we used to have more of, the poor and the recently middle class or low middle class who are now no longer so well off are being squeezed and squeezed and squeezed. And so what is the solution? I don't know. People like Rick have those solutions. They work hard to do what I report on. So,
well, what can motivate developers to build more low-income housing?
If I can answer that
sure,
question,
go ahead, Richard.
It's a way to, first of all, energize a community to become active in this process. So in a Garfield, for example, we need to have a community organization like the Bloomfield Garfield Corporation who says, you know what, we're going to make this part of our mission in the neighborhood. Secondly, you're going to have a city government that's very receptive to helping you assemble the site or sites to do the housing development itself at a relatively inexpensive cost. Thirdly, you're going to need to find a private developer who has experience in all of the aspects of financing and managing the construction of a project, because most of that capacity does not lie within the community itself. And then I think fourth, you're going to have a strong management component, because even longtime residents of Garfield who would like to see affordable housing built are not going to accept housing that's poorly managed, where tenants are not well screened, and where there isn't some incentive for even the tenants, the new tenants, to go to work each day perhaps as the longtime residents do. So people want to know that even if we solve an economic problem, that it doesn't lead to a social problem in the community.
Richard, how do land banks work and how can the proposed land bank figure in?
I think the land bank would bring out into the public limelight a process that pretty much is obscured to the average city resident. The land bank would have a board of directors who would have the resources to help with both the site acquisition and site disposition to facilitate this kind of housing development. Now, of course, it presumes that communities like a Garfield or Hazelwood or Beltsuver want to have this type of housing in their neighborhood and under what terms and conditions. But the land bank would bring out into the public view a process that is very much obscure today and could also be very much subject to political decision-making, every bit as much as economic decision-making.
What about existing structures? Pittsburgh has something like 13,000 and 17,000 vacant buildings. Is it better to fix up these homes or tear them down and start fresh? What's the most affordable approach?
I'm not real sure what the most affordable approach is. I think it depends on where it is, the size of the property, and maybe who the recipients are. I certainly would love to see some of the good structures in some of the neighborhoods that have fallen into hard times recently being salvaged if possible. I was just suggesting that maybe it would be kind of cool if you got a whole bunch of artists to take them over, just give it to them, and let them make the renovation of those properties into an art project and maybe, you know, highlight that as a way to get some of these properties back into
So maybe do it as a barter arrangement where if you are working on fixing this up, you can live there for a reduced rate or maybe even for free.
Yeah, I mean, it's how they got the North Side going back in the 70s. They gave homes away. I think it was a $100 house sale, or maybe it was $1,000. But yes, they got a whole bunch of people who had some means but maybe would never have thought about moving to the North Side back in the late 70s to go ahead and take on a house that they had to fix up. And subsequently, 10, 15, 20 houses were fixed up in that project, and then the wheels started to turn on their own. So something has to be done creatively. It's obviously the paradigm that we're working under now is just not going to fix 13,000 to 17,000 properties.
I think, too, the economics of it are that with scatter site houses like these in every neighborhood, having them become rental units is probably not going to work from a feasibility standpoint, because these houses can require upwards of $100,000 to $150,000 worth of work to make them truly habitable again. So you're looking at an owner-occupied strategy. The neighborhood would then have to ask the question, owner-occupy for what segment of the market? Diana just described a segment of the market, artists who would be hopefully owner-occupants. In some neighborhoods, that may not be well received because sometimes artists are seen as the first wave of gentrifiers. So you're going to have a financing mechanism, and I think the Urban Redevelopment Authority is working with several banks right now to create a new program that would offer a loan for both the purchase and the rehabilitation of a structure in one loan. And you're going to have to, through a land bank, work selectively to identify the properties in your neighborhood that you think are salvageable. You're going to have to get them into the land bank and hold them for future sale. And that's why the land bank is so important, because if there isn't an entity like that, let's say, to receive the house in the short term and hold on to it until the plan for development is ready, then the house more than likely remains vacant and could eventually fall victim to demolition. So in Garfield, we are selectively demolishing houses all the time because they are no longer feasible to renovate. We're also salvaging houses that we have deemed to be capable of being rehabilitated and then sold off to an owner-occupant.
And so Pittsburgh, with its blight and vacant buildings, there are a lot of those here. Do you see this as a way of getting properties out of the hands of absentee landlords? And if, you know, how do you do that?
I think the only leverage you're going to have with absentee landlords, and it's another place where the land bank is going to be quintessential, is tax delinquent owner absence site owned properties. We have a number of them in Garfield. Every city neighborhood is littered with private owners who've fallen behind in the taxes on these rental units. You're going to have to push them to a tax foreclosure process while avoiding the displacement of the residents in the house. The city does not have the capacity to do that today. The city will not take an occupied house in Garfield for the back taxes. They do not want the liability of having to manage that property. The land bank would have a staff, hopefully within it, that could manage it in the short term until you can find another owner for that property.
And then another question becomes, how do you keep this from turning into a handout to Buncher and other powerful developers?
I have an answer.
Yeah.
It's not too hard to do. First of all, the top shelf private developers like Walnut Capital and Buncher really are not focused on the Garfields, the Homewoods, the Larimers, the Beltshoovers of the world. They're still focusing on East Liberty. They're looking at the neighborhoods where the return on the dollar is going to be much greater. So there's an opportunity now for some of these communities to get organized, to have a neighborhood plan that clearly articulates a long-term strategy for the neighborhood, and then use that as the basis for future decisions about development. It's not right for a community organization to veto somebody from being able to buy a property in their community and develop it as they wish, but at least to have the community, you know, providing support because it does follow the neighborhood plan in some way. So I think you're going to have that to keep developers from exploiting what are traditionally disadvantaged neighborhoods.
We're talking about the issue of development and the exclusion of people who are in the working class from being able to attain affordable housing with Pittsburgh Post-Gazette writer Diana Nelson-Jones and also Richard Swartz, executive director of the Bloomfield Garfield Corporation, here with us in studio. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. We would like to hear from you, particularly about your search for affordable housing. What kind of hurdles have you run into? What kind of solutions have you seen that are out there? 412-246-2002. Share your story with us. What can communities or municipalities do to incentivize the situation for developers? Are there any examples out there?
Yes, quite a few, as a matter of fact. The URA has incentivized development at the Southside Works, at Bakery Square, and Bakery Square 2.0. So the first tool that they have in their toolbox is to help with infrastructure costs. These are the things that have to be available to that housing unit regardless of who's living in it. So sewer lines, water lines, sidewalks, catch basins, grading, demolishing existing structures. That part can be borne on the public dollar. That then allows the private resources to go just into the development of the unit itself. Secondly, and they do employ this tactic quite a bit, deferring the real estate taxes or allowing the assessments to be done at a reduced cost to the owner. We're having a bit of a conversation right now with the County Board of Assessment about how well they're handling this process. But it needs better definition, because if I'm renting a unit for $700 a month and the unit costs me $150,000 to build, the worst thing that can happen is to have an assessment on that unit for $150,000. There's no way then that I can rent it for $700 a month. I think thirdly, to use some things like tax increment financing that would allow the projected real estate revenues to be plowed back into the development to help service debt associated with the development. The only way you can build affordable housing in Pittsburgh is to limit the debt on the unit from the get-go. If you're going to come out of the gate with a $100,000 loan on each rental unit that you want to provide to the working class, it is not going to work financially. So there has to be some subsidiary financing or you have to employ some gimmicks like TIFs to be able to reduce the long-term carrying cost on that unit.
Let's go to the phones, 412-246-2002. We have Tara on the line from Pittsburgh. Tara, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you.
Go ahead with your comment or question.
Yeah, my comment is my fiance and I just bought a house in the Perry South neighborhood, and it was it's a rehab house, and we used HUD's FHA 203K loan program, and I was just curious what anybody's thoughts were on that program and whether there was any way that program could kind of get out there more and help some of these neighborhoods, you know, that have great houses that need to be rehabbed. We found it to be, so far, a pretty good deal for us to rehab this great old house.
I think you just cited a good example of how a home buyer who has the willingness and the capacity to manage their own renovation plan for the house can get that accomplished. So that's a good vehicle that HUD uses. It insures the mortgage loan so that if indeed the borrower defaults, the lender doesn't take the full loss on that. The URA, as I noted earlier, is working with the banks to create a local variant on that program. That's the combined purchase and rehab program. For working class people, they need a little more technical assistance in managing that process. Many of them go to work during the day. They're not home to work with a contractor who's doing the renovation work. Things can get out of hand very quickly. But that is a strategy still that if a community group like the Bloomfield-Garfield Corporation can work with that home buyer and make sure that a good contractor is found and the work gets done promptly, it's a very effective way to go. That HUD program has a lot of paperwork attached to it, but a lot of people, like the caller, probably had a lot of incentive to want to do the paperwork because the payoff at the end was great. You had one combined loan payment.
Tara, thank you for that phone call. We appreciate it. Diana Nelson-Jones, hasn't it been shown that mixed-income neighborhoods do better for all residents?
Yeah, the best thinking on the topic in the past probably 15 years has been that you don't want pockets of poverty. That was the whole problem in the first place. You know, you put people on reservations far from where everybody else is sort of having fun, and you know they're stuck and all poor together. The better method is to have market rate, mixed income, mixed use, you know, near bus lines, near stores and things like that. So that is a good model. What happened though was that it's less dense, and so it's great. You have more green space, but you just the number of people who are in the high rises are now scattered further, and many of them aren't finding in the city the kinds of rents they can afford. Fewer and fewer parts of the city.
What's the minimum salary people need to make to afford market rate housing?
Okay, so the hourly wage necessary for a 2-bedroom market rate apartment is $18.79. That's the equivalent of 2.6 full-time minimum wage jobs.
And so as the president tries to address – and others tries to address this problem of income disparity, if we don't address that, is there a direct correlation between that problem and what we're seeing in Pittsburgh with the lack of affordable housing? And you're nodding,
yeah.
Richard.
Yeah. I think the federal government right now has absolutely no role in what we're talking about today other than for Congress to allow the tax credit program to continue and to provide some small subsidies to agencies like the Urban Redevelopment Authority or the Housing Authority of the City of Pittsburgh to try to get development like this done. So I think if you're going to address income inequality, you're going to have to stabilize somebody's housing cost. Because right now, as neighborhoods gentrify, if you're a low-income resident, the handwriting is pretty much on the wall. At some point, the owner of your property is going to realize that I could gain a lot more by selling the house to somebody who would then use it for their own purposes than I can by continuing to rent it to a working-class family. So by developing new housing through entities like the tax credit partnerships that we've used, you can get somebody into a unit in Garfield where the three-bedroom unit rents for $725 a month. So if you do the math, $725 a month requires a gross annual income of $28,000 to $30,000 a year, and now you've stabilized their housing situation, and suddenly they can try to get ahead a little further in life.
We've been talking about how to address the problem of the lack of affordable housing in Pittsburgh with Pittsburgh Post-Gazette writer Diana Nelson and also Richard Swartz, executive director of the Bloomfield Garfield Corporation, joining us in Studio A. Thank you both for being with us. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Coming up, a conversation with U.S. Women's Olympic ice hockey goalie Breanne McLaughlin. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.